Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We are going to be exploring a different side of the battle space of the War of Ideas today. We talk about Sharia frequently here. We have someone who aspires to bring it to America with us for the full hour, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Anjem Chowdhury. You have probably seen him on several television programs of late, notably with Sean Hannity, quite a spirited conversation. He and I have had the opportunity to have our own little bit of debate with Sean Hannity moderating one, and just this week, Steve Gill moderating another. And I thought, well, Anjem, if you would be willing, let's do it ourselves. Let's remove the middleman and let's have a proper conversation about some of the issues that we both feel strongly about. You as a proponent of Sharia, myself as a adamant opponent of it, and let's explore some of the different aspects of it. Anjem is a former head of an organization in Britain called Al Muhajirin. He is a lecturer in Sharia law. He is a practicing barrister, as I understand it, in Britain. He is a man who has very explicitly called for Sharia to be brought to Britain and to be brought to the United States, indicating earlier on this month that he was going to come and talk about it outside the White House. That didn't happen, but he's here with us today, and I'm very pleased to have you with us. Anjem Chowdhury, thank you for joining us.
Yes, you're welcome.
Let me start with one of the key questions in my mind as I listen to you. You have been rather direct compared certainly to some who I think also share your aspiration that Sharia rule worldwide about what is involved. But I'd like, if I could, to get just a kind of calibration about where you come from and how what you say should be seen by those of us who are not Muslim, those of us who are not in favor of Sharia particularly, as to the authority with which you speak. And I don't necessarily mean personally, I'm simply saying in terms of when you say some of the things that we'll be talking about in the course of the program, how, for example, would you say they square with the teachings of such authorities within the Muslim world as Al-Azhar, the university in Cairo, or the Organization of the Islamic Conference, or Sayyid Qutb of Milestones and Brotherhood fame, or Yusuf al-Qaradawi, one of the eminent figures today. How does your thinking or your lines track with theirs or deviate from it?
Yes, that's an excellent question, actually, to begin with. And let me begin as well by saying that, you know, I have no doubt that many of your listeners will want to hear about Islam and will want to hear both sides of the argument. So it's very good to have a one-to-one as opposed to a third person interrupting all the time. And, you know, as far as Islam is concerned, I think what we can agree is that the word Islam means submission to the command of God. And what we can say as well at the outset is that we all want benefit in this life and to prevent harm, and we all want as well paradise in the hereafter, whether you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim. I think our aspirations are the same there. As far as the jurisprudential point is concerned, as far as Islam is concerned, there are some matters which are known from Islam by necessity, where the scholars and the people who are not scholars must agree because they are so abundantly clear from the divine text that nobody can differ with them. And I don't think that you'll find that anyone really differs with them. And certainly if somebody does differ with them, then they are by no means a scholar or learned in Islam. And I think that that is the parameter, if you like, for measuring anyone who is knowledgeable or not knowledgeable in the basics of Islam. But then you get into difficulty nowadays, because we are living in a time where the Sharia is not being implemented on state level. Therefore, we don't have, for example, a university which is completely independent, where the only objective is to please God and implement the Sharia, you know, in our lives and within society, and to teach people properly, so that they will then one day be scholars of Islam. Rather, what we have is institutions like Al-Azhar and various other universities, and by the way, Al-Azhar means university, in the Muslim world, who are under dictators. You know, in Egypt, as you know, Hosni Mubarak was in charge, and in many other countries, like King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia, are dictators and tyrants. And therefore, there's no way that you're going to be able to go to those universities and end up with a broad and enlightened understanding of Islam. Rather, it will be an Islam which accords with their own agenda. Therefore, if you want to find out who the real scholars are, then I suggest you look in the prisons, for example, in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and in other parts of the Muslim world, where you'll find that those people who had the fortitude to speak the truth are, in fact, persecuted. And, you know, if you were to ask me who I think are the scholars of Islam today, I would say people like Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad, who is currently in Lebanon, actually an artist from Britain, people like Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who's been in and out of jail in Jordan, people like Sheikh Abu Qatada, who's in prison in Britain, you know, Nasser al-Fahd, I could go on. But most of these people are persecuted, and you don't hear from them nowadays.
All right, and those folks, for the purposes of our audience's understanding, would I gather, I know some of them better than others, all by reputation, of course, but they would be considered in our country as terrorists or sponsors of terrorism, or certainly enthusiastic supporters of the concept that violent jihad should be an instrument for bringing about the triumph that I think you all aspire to. You've said so quite explicitly, namely a worldwide Sharia rule. And am I right in characterizing them that way?
Well, you know, I would differ with your terminology, Frank. As you know, I don't believe that there's something called radical or violent or, you know, moderate.
I didn't use any of those words.
Just so I'm clear.
Forgive me. Just one second, if I may, just to clarify. I will not use the term radical or extremist or fundamentalist. I think violence is a fairly, objective characterization of a practice that is not peaceable. It is the opposite of it. So I will use that to characterize the kind of jihad that I believe these guys are associated with. And so take it from there.
Well, I would say that there is a concept called jihad which is very noble. You see, so, I mean, you can use it pejoratively if you wish, but there is something called jihad in Islam. And obviously, linguistically, the word means to struggle, whereas as far as the juristic understanding is concerned, there is something called jihad mubada and jihad dafi. Jihad mubada is by the Islamic State to remove obstacles in the way of implementing the Sharia outside of the frontiers of an Islamic State, of which, incidentally, we have none nowadays. And jihad dafi is the right, the noble right and duty to defend your life, honor, and property where it is being attacked. So that is taking place, for example, in Palestine, in Kashmir, in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. So, I mean, yes, certainly any scholar who is worthy of the name nowadays must talk about the vital issues which are affecting the Muslims nowadays. And that is not halal meat or circumcision. That is the occupation of Muslim land, the lack of the Sharia being implemented on law and order. And if they are not talking about those issues, then quite frankly, they're not putting priority properly as far as the jurisprudence is concerned.
Okay. Very good. We're talking with Amjam Chowdhury, a practitioner of Sharia himself, a man who aspires to have us all submit to it, one form or another. Anjum, on this question of whether there is any place in the world where Sharia is being observed and implemented governmentally by the state, as I think you put it, certainly to those of us outside of the Muslim community, there seems to be a number of states, notably Saudi Arabia, Iran, Sudan, Somalia, where the Taliban rules in Afghanistan or Pakistan, in those countries, and certainly on a sort of sliding scale, the implementation of it elsewhere in the Muslim world. We're going to have to pause here for a moment, but I just want to sort of set up the next part of our conversation with Anjum Chowdhury by saying I understand the distinction you're making, and we'll get into this after the break, to be that you don't have a theocratic ruler governing in these states. You have a despot, you have a tyrant, except in Iran, where, of course, you do have a theocratic ruler, but that's a Shia government, and we'll get into that, too. But I do want to explore with you, Anjem, how it is that these governments that certainly say they're trying to implement Sharia, and certainly, according to what we know of Sharia in the West, seem to be not only practicing its penal code, but its treatment of women and other things with considerable diligence, why, in your estimation, they don't qualify as Sharia states. And we'll do this all in the segment to come with Anjem Chowdhury, formerly of Al-Mawhajirun. I'm mangling that name, but it's a hard one. After the break, here at Secure Freedom Radio, you're not going to want to miss this conversation. Stay tuned.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Michael Medved is asking Congress to simplify the corporate tax code for good reason.
This is a real problem. Of the 500 top Fortune companies, nearly 100 pay no taxes because they use various dodges
that have been written into the law by lobbyists.
And the President of the United States and Paul Ryan, the House Budget Chair,
and John Boehner, the Speaker of the House,
everybody ought to work together to get rid of this stuff.
It's just wrong.
The Michael Medved Show. Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260. WRC, New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined once again by Anjem Chowdhury, a very controversial figure, a man I am now sparring with some regularity, and he was kind enough to join us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Anjem, before the break, we talked a little bit about why you think governments that hold themselves up as implementing Sharia actually don't. And I want to go beyond just who's ruling. I want to know what it is about these states that is short of, in your estimation, the mark in terms of the faithful implementation of the program.
Yeah. I think what you can safely say is that we need to make a distinction between what we say is Diyar al-Muslimin, in other words, property which is owned by Muslims, and Darul Islam, which is the homeland of Islam where the Sharia is implemented. Today we have 55 countries, so-called Muslim countries. All of them are in some way dictatorial monarchy regimes, or they're implementing some type of secularism, where Islam has nothing to do, in fact, with running the affairs of society. Therefore, none of them are, in fact, an Islamic state, including Iran. If you want to measure them, then I would say that the actual ruling system in Islam is based upon five pillars, and I'll go through them very quickly for your listeners. The first one is called Al-Hakimiyya Lillah, that supremacy belongs to God. In other words, that is part of our belief that everything in society must be run according to God's law. The second pillar, we say, is Siyada Lil-Shara'i, that every single law must be derived from the Qur'an and the Sunnah, which is the sayings and actions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Therefore, there should not even be one law outside of the ambit of the revelation. Third one, we say Sultan al-Muslimin, the authority must be in the hands of the Muslims. And an indication, by the way, that we don't have that nowadays is that the Muslims are not consulted. They have no shura council. If they rise their voice against the oppression, they're usually arrested. They are not consulted. They cannot appoint their own leaders. As you know, leadership is handed nowadays from father to son, etc. And the fourth element, or the fourth pillar of the ruling system, is haqq al-qarar, the right of decision rests solely with the Khalifa, who is the head of the Islamic State. And number five, that as well, you can only have, we say, wahdatun Khalifa wal Khilafa. There can only be one leader and one Islamic State. In other words, all of the Muslims must be under one leader worldwide, who they must abide by. Obviously, he can have walad, he can have governors and governorships in different areas and regions, but they must all be united under one leader. And obviously, you can see from those parameters that none of that exists nowadays.
Well, it would seem to most closely approximate what they're doing in Iran, where there is clearly a Muslim, if you don't want to call him a caliph, a theocratic ruler, who is implementing, according to a program that it would seem approximates shura councils, clerics, authorities in Islam. Is the problem there basically that it's Shia, not Sunni, or is the problem that there are other mechanics of the arrangement that make it less than the ideal Sharia state?
No, I mean, there's a number of things. I mean, first of all, the leader in Iran must be Persian. That is clear racism, which is completely unacceptable in Islam. Number two, they are signatories to the United Nations. That is not allowed as well. You cannot have a body which implements man-made law over and above the Sharia. We believe Islam is superior to any other law and order. Moreover, they have an interest-based banking system as well in Iran. And, you know, they have fixed borders, and borders are completely prohibited in Islam as well. The Prophet said whoever puts a border is being cursed. And, you know, I mean, for those simple reasons, it's not an Islamic state. You have to implement the Sharia internally and externally, and the Sharia must be supreme, and that is certainly not the case in Iran.
Okay, so, Anjum Chowdhury, we're finding some places in which the arrangements by which these governments operate, on what I'm sure each of them would say is a transitional arrangement, not a permanent one. They aspire to have a worldwide caliphate and so on. Let me just ask you to drill down here, because when you talk about bringing Sharia to America, as you do, presumably what you are talking about has some relationship, at the very least, to what is characterizing Sharia in its practice elsewhere around the world. For example, when we talked yesterday on Steve Gill's show, you, I think, acknowledged that there was a penal code that is part and parcel of Sharia. You found fault, as I recall, with the Saudis that they were implementing that, but not these other elements. But you don't disagree, do you, with some of the practices that are, in fact, evident in Saudi Arabia and Iran and these other so-called Sharia states, that most of us in America find not only abhorrent but barbaric and totally antithetical to the Constitution and the protections that it provides for, you know, women and homosexuals and people who choose to leave the faith and Jews and so on, and petty criminals for that matter. Does this not still, even with your caveats, provide us a point of understanding a component, at the very least, of what Sharia is that is fair game for us to say no thanks to?
Well, no, I don't think it does. I mean, certainly, you know, I'm not going to say that there is no penal code in Islam. And what tends to happen is that people do look at places like Saudi Arabia and Sudan, and they see that certain elements of the penal code are seen to be implemented, for example, to cut the hand of the thief, to stone the adulterer, and so on. But the problem that we have, you see, Frank, is that the system of Islam needs to be implemented as a whole. If you don't have the education system in place, teaching people about their relationship with God, you don't provide the basic needs for the people, the food, clothing, and shelter, and make sure that they are fully provided for, and you don't have a social system in place, then the judiciary ultimately is something which is there as a kind of a last barrier to make sure that people abide by the Sharia. It's not something that people should use as a mallet in order to beat the people into submission. And what is in fact taking place is that these governments don't provide the basic needs of the people. They don't have the social and economic justice of Islam. They don't have the education system. The rest of the apparatus is in fact completely missing. So from the outside, what appears is just the penal code. And obviously, people then engender hatred towards Islam because they say, look at the way that people are being dealt with. And that is just not the case. I mean, famously, Umar bin al-Khattab, radiallahu anhu, the second Khalifa, did not implement parts of the penal code when there were, like, for example, famine and drought, because the basic needs were not being met. So that is the way the whole picture is enveloped together. And, you know, I will just say that, you know, in 1,300 years of the Sharia being implemented, the judicial records show that less than 200 hands were ever cut. There were less than 60 reported rapes. And, you know, the incidence of crime was very, very low. And, in fact, things like poverty were completely eradicated in certain periods. Whereas, you know, if you look, for example, at Saudi Arabia today, the only people who are, in fact, the subject of the penal code are those people who are second or third class citizens, which is, again, completely prohibited in Islam, like the Bengalis or the Pakistanis or the Koreans. And when it comes to the Saudis or the Americans or those who people are the allies to them, they are never, in fact, subject to any kind of punishment. So we can see that this is being used as a tool in order to look Islamic, but in fact it is not Islamic at all.
Yeah. It certainly looks Islamic to us in terms of the penal code being authentically drawn from the sacred texts, the Quran, the Sunnah, as you say, and how the rest of it fits together. I mean, what you've described, Anjum Chowdhury, in terms of the program in its entirety of economic and social justice and the rest, really strikes one as perhaps the sort of paragon of a program of, well, the communists in their day, the fascists in their day, you know, other arranged political arrangements, but in the end, it's unachievable in a world in which humans actually operate. And the closest you ever get to it is a kind of totalitarianism that does establish classes. It does treat some people better than others. It does penalize those who are weaker or less favored than others. And I guess, Anjum, just to bring it back from the theoretical to the very real, when you say very explicitly you want to bring Sharia to America, surely you appreciate that those of us who favor freedom, who favor with all of its, you know, pluses and minuses, a capitalist system whereby people have the opportunity to make their way on the basis of their abilities and their, you know, their drive, rather than have some higher authority distributing wealth on some other basis. When we hear people like you say, well, it'll all work out. Trust us. If we have this perfect arrangement, the penal system won't be so bad. You won't even miss your freedoms. Most of us have to say, I think, and I don't want to overstate this, but thanks but no thanks seems to me to be at the very least what you're going to hear from Americans, especially, and we're going to have to pause here one more time, especially since it has never worked out. I mean, you say for 1,000 years maybe, but I honestly don't, in my study of history, think it worked out all that swimmingly either. But we'll visit with you about that more in a moment. Anjum Chowdhury is with us, an explicit, articulate proponent of bringing Sharia to a neighborhood near you. It's more straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, A fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by Anjum Chowdhury for a serious adult conversation about our differences about Sharia. And Anjum, great to have you with us. You wanted to respond to my last observation.
Yes, I would just say that, when one looks at the communist model, suddenly one cannot point to any kind of period in history where it was implemented. Perhaps you would look at the French Revolution, and they look, for example, at Cuba and China and certain places where elements of socialism are being implemented. But the whole model was not, in fact, ever a law and order. Whereas if you look in Islam, it was implemented from the time of the Prophet until the 3rd of March 1924, which is the demise of the Ottoman Empire. And can I just say, during that period, in fact, the whole of the Sharia was implemented as a law and order. And if you look, for example, at certain periods, we can look, for example, at Spain during those 800 years, the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians did live side by side, as opposed to living in stone hovels with a hole in the roof and handing down, animal furs from generation to generation. The Muslims, when they took power, built 200,000 homes, half a million places of worship. There were street lights, pavements, etc. We could go on and on about the material progress and the intellectual progress that was made in that era. So, and I would say that there's obviously a clear distinction. In the other thing, of course, is the thing with communism is that people believe in the equal distribution of wealth, whereas what we are saying is that there is a problem with the management and the distribution. And there should not be equal distribution. Rather, the basic needs should be met for every citizen, and they can work for their privileges. So here we make a distinction. But at the same time, the money which is being frittered away, for example, in America and other countries through pornography, gambling, alcohol, and many of the other industries, would be reinvested in education and health and in useful exploits. So there's a big distinction between what you're saying and what you're saying.
What you are making clear is that there is some sort of diktat from on high about how people will live their lives, how they will use what money or resources are available. And, you know, again, it's just antithetical to how we believe freedom and choice should operate and does here in the United States at the moment. And I just have to say, I mean, you have brought up in several of our previous conversations this idea of this sort of Andalus as an exemplar of how this would work. You say the Christians and Jews live side by side. I think it is fair to say they did not live side by side. They lived underneath as dhimmis. And I'd like to ask you, if I could, Anjum Chaudhry, to explore with us this idea. There are clearly classes in a Sharia society, with Muslims being preferred, those who choose not to convert and who just as soon not die but are willing to submit, which is what really I think this comes down to, is you've said there's no compulsion in religion. In fact, there is compulsion in religion under the sort of 385, and it definitely makes clear that those who choose not to either convert, choose not to be killed, have to be second-class citizens, and certainly were in Spain, and I think would be in any place where this Sharia program takes over. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, you know, what we say is that there is no compulsion on an individual level to embrace Islam. However, as far as the society is concerned, the Sharia would be implemented. And you're quite right in that there are no Muslims are called dhimmis. But if I could quote to you, for example, just two of the sayings of the Prophet. For example, in Tabarani, the Prophet said, whoever oppresses a dhimmi, i.e. a non-Muslim, and does not fulfill his rights or asks him more than he can do, I will be a plaintiff against him on the day of judgment. And in another narration, in Fath al-Bari, from Abdullah bin Amru, that the Prophet said, whoever kills a dhimmi or someone with a treaty with us will never smell a paradise, and yet you can smell it from a distance of 40 years. So the non-Muslims are not going to be oppressed, rather their rights will be protected, they'll have the basic needs of food, clothing, and shelter, they will never form part of the army, rather the Muslims will be obliged to be part of the army to defend their honor and their wealth and their status. So I think, you know, there's a bit of a misunderstanding here that they're going to be oppressed. And incidentally, you know, many Orientalists
Anjum, just one second, just on that point. Let's pause for just one second to clarify, because what you've described is a kind of benevolent, you would have us believe, but nonetheless, well, dictatorial arrangement vis-a-vis these other folks, and as a group, certainly, whether their individual practice is directly interfered with, as a group, there's very little question, I hope, either from what you've said or what we know about Sharia, that they would not be able to sort of exhibit their faith or practice their faith in the kind of public way that Muslims would, and to the extent they could do it at all. And you've mentioned that some churches and mosques, you know, continued to exist in Spain. Synagogues and churches existed in Spain during the Andalus period. The reality is that it was clearly only at the sufferance of Muslims. And again, this is just in stark contrast to one of our fundamental tenets in our Constitution, as you know, which is freedom of religion, freedom for Muslims to practice their faith, freedom for these other faiths to do so as equals, not as preferred groups and in some cases, not at all.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's a whole debate taking place actually at the moment in Europe about multiculturalism, meaning that can you have your own culture? and exist independently, or do you have one? Do you need to have one kind of a homogenous whole, where everybody must abide by core values, be they British or French, and so on? The way that we look at the problem, and the way the Divine Text says, is that yes, I mean, you are, if you are a Muslim, then you're obliged to pray. For example, you're obliged to go to pray on Friday. You must fast and you must go to Hajj, etc. And obviously, there are certain punishments if you don't fulfil those duties. Whereas for the non-Muslim, he would never be obliged to do any of those. And obviously, you know, he will as well, you know, have his own rights and duties. So you can, you know, you'll have the church, you will still exist. What you will still be able to get married according to your own rituals. And what you do in your home, obviously, nobody will ever spy on you. And obviously, they will have full right to the welfare system. In fact, the non-Muslims can live anywhere in the Muslim land and can go everywhere except where Allah has prohibited, which is Mecca. And they cannot live in the Arabian Peninsula. Otherwise, they are free to travel anywhere. And in fact, you know, uniquely, Islam does not have entry visas. Rather, you need to have an exit visa. So when people leave the Islamic State, they need to ask permission. Otherwise, everybody is welcome to come to the Islamic State. So there are some fundamental differences. But I think, you know, you need to put these as well into context. And I was just going to say that the jizya...
Which is the tax
which non-Muslims pay, and in return their life and what is protected. You know, for some of the ulama, it's 4 dinar. And by the way, 1 dinar is about £150, I think, or something like that nowadays in today's money. So 4 dinar a year is, you know, merely £600 English money, sterling. Whereas the zakat, which a Muslim has to pay, is phenomenally more if he has the requisite amount per year. And the jizya, incidentally, is not taken from women, it's not taken from children, it's not taken from the elderly, it's not taken from people who are not capable of working, you know, and don't have the money. So, you know, and it's much less if you're poor than if you're rich. So I think that these things as well, you know, it's explained, one will understand, in fact, that there are many rights and duties which are enjoyed by the non-Muslims, and in fact, which are unique. And I think this is the important point, Frank, that you need to treat people uniquely. You cannot push everyone into one hole and just expect everyone to obey the same laws when their beliefs and their systems of life are different.
Well, but there seems a bit of an internal contradiction here, because I thought I heard you say a moment ago, Anjum Chowdhury, that we are, you know, to be critical of Saudi Arabia because it is treating people differently. And yet, on the other hand, you've just affirmed that Islam, in fact, does treat people differently.
No.
And again, I want to make sure this is relevant.
Though,
well, no, but second-class citizens and so on. And I think there's really no other way to describe what's going on here.
There's racism. Saudi Arabia, what I was saying is that there's racism. That's not what exists in Islam. Islam treats people differently according to their own status. And it's not about racism. It's not about your color. It's not about, you know...
It's about your faith.
Treating you according to your beliefs.
About your beliefs. Yeah, no, that is, I'm endlessly told, because frankly, folks who are on your side of this equation are endlessly calling me a racist, because I am suggesting that a system that does, in fact, discriminate against people on the basis of their belief, namely yours, is in fact totally at odds with our form of government, our constitution, our social values. And we'll pick up on this side, the other side of the break on this point as well, Anjum Chowdhury. We're looking at, I think, a very different view of things. We do not favor racism in this country. We had a history of it in the past. We've moved, I think, light years away from it. People like me are not racist for pointing out that people like you are, in fact, prepared to impose a kind of class system, albeit on the basis of, as you say, belief. That's not America. That's not, I think, what we want to have in America. And we'll explore with you on the other side of this very short pause several of the other attributes of this Sharia program that I think are equally abhorrent. And we'll get your view on them. Straight ahead, more with Anjum Chowdhury.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Nothing gets Mike Gallagher more upset than when the government tries to tell him how to live his life.
For the government to urge the Restaurant Association of America, or whatever it's called, oh, you got to start serving smaller portions.
The government doesn't belong there.
Stay out of our restaurants, stay out of our kitchens, stay out of our lives.
The Mike Gallagher Show.
It's infuriating to me.
Weekdays from 9 to noon on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq, Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined for our concluding segment with Anjem Chowdhury. We have been discussing with him in, I'm happy to say, a very civil and thoughtful way, the profound differences that we feel about the program he seeks to bring to our country, America, and indeed worldwide. And Anjem, thank you again for joining us and for making yourself available for an extended interview on the subject. I want specifically to visit with you about the Muslim Brotherhood. Because, as you know, we are discussing a lot lately with their seeming imminent rise to power in Egypt. and perhaps elsewhere in the Middle East, the prospect that we will see states that favor rather more your view of things, I think, than mine, emerging. And we're also seeing people beginning to talk much more seriously, I think, about the Muslim Brotherhood's role in the West, including in Europe, of course, where you hail from now, and here in the United States. And I'd like to get your take on the differences, if you have any, with the Muslim Brotherhood about the approach that they have to bringing about Sharia. If, in fact, you have any differences about the nature of Sharia with the Brotherhood, or whether it's really just a question of modalities for accomplishing the end state that you both share.
Yes, indeed. As far as the Ikhwan al-Muslimin are concerned in Egypt, they have been around, obviously, for decades, and they have changed dramatically, in fact, after the rise against the British in the 30s and 40s. And then, of course, at the beginning of the 1970s, you know, that individuals like Sheikh Umar Abdurrahman, he set up Tanzim al-Jihad, and even individuals like Sheikh Ayman al-Zawahiri can find their roots in the Brotherhood. So you can see that, in fact, they've split, and there's a portion of them who believe in jihad as the method to overthrow the current regimes in Muslim countries. And there's another portion who believe in sharing power and eventually being in a position where they can actually wield power and therefore implement the Sharia. And then we find as well within the Ummah there are a third type of people who believe to isolate themselves and who believe the status quo is fine. And obviously as far as the third one is concerned, that does not merit any kind of consideration because there's no Islamic opinion or school of thought there whatsoever. I would even go so far as to say that sharing power is something which is anathema, in fact, to what the Prophet did. He never compromised in any law or any divine rule whatsoever throughout the whole of his life, whether he was living in Mecca or Medina. So, in fact, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there is an overlap. The ultimate objective for us and for them and for Muslims worldwide, I believe, must be to implement the Sharia on state level. The question is what methodology you employ. And here we differ with the Ikhwan al-Muslimin in Egypt at the current time.
Yeah, and yet we hear that the history of Muhammad's own life, which is, as you know, the example that all Muslims are enjoined to follow, did in fact, when the, if you will, the correlation of forces was adverse to him, involve making hudnas or ceasefires or temporary agreements with more powerful tribes in order to achieve the ultimate violent defeat of those tribes. And is that not basically the model of the Ikhwan, as you call it, the Muslim Brotherhood, to not to do anything other than sort of have a transitional arrangement, what they call civilization jihad, a stealthy kind of jihad that is pre-violent rather than violent, but basically is simply trying to get to the same place that you and others who are prepared to go more directly there would pursue?
Well, I think that there are two very distinct points here. The first one is that the Prophet lived his life over 23 years, and we don't believe, in fact, that now that the religion is complete and the whole of the Quran has been revealed and an example is there for all of us to follow, that we can, in fact, live in Mecca or Medina. We must live in a time when the whole of the religion is incumbent and applied upon us. As far as the Ikhwan al-Muslimin are concerned, yes, I mean, certainly they believe in a concept called tadarruj, gradualism, that they believe that slowly, slowly you can be in a position of rulership. And they extract, obviously, certain rulings from Mecca and Medina in order to support that. What I would say is that that's not a very strong opinion whatsoever. And in fact, there's no room for compromise. And I differ with the fact that the Prophet ever compromised. Rather, if the revelation had not been revealed at that time, then there is no law on that issue. So, for example, alcohol was not prohibited until Medina. So no one can say that you can drink alcohol now because we don't have an Islamic state, which is a little bit akin to Mecca, where there was no Sharia being implemented, because this would obviously be absurd. The whole of the Quran must be implemented as well as the Sunnah. So there is no argument as far as that is concerned. What I would argue, and our difference with Ikhwan al-Muslimin, is that we believe that the Prophet changed the society with creating an intellectual revolution on the ground, in other words, culturing the people about Islam as a way of life. And at the same time, he incited certain elements within the army in Medina to overthrow the regime and to put the authority in the hands of the Muslims. So we believe a combination of both of those is the way forward and the model of the Prophet.
Yeah, and I want to come to that in just a closing moment here, but just before we get to that, this concept of what was said last, what was revealed last, what was acted upon last, known as the principle of abrogation, I guess is what you're speaking of here, that what was done in Medina actually is the authoritative practice of the faith, not what preceded it in Mecca.
Well, no, I mean, there's certainly a concept called an-nasikh wal-mansukh, the abrogator, and they abrogated in Islam. But that does not mean that everything which went before is abrogated. Rather, there are certain rules which were changed, but in essence, the concept of dawah, propagation of Islam, commanding good and forbidding evil, living by the sharia in the whole of your life, and the basics of Islam, you know, in prayer, in making supplication, etc., are all the same. Yes, certainly there are new laws in terms of ruling, in terms of social economy, etc., which were revealed in Medina, because the Prophet had authority there, and he was implementing it as leader of the Islamic State, which was not the case in Mecca. But one cannot say the whole of them, the Meccan period, has been abrogated.
No, I don't mean to suggest that the whole of it has been, but the parts where, for example, we are endlessly told the peaceable nature of the faith is subsequently amended, shall we say, or abrogated in favor of one that says you must make them feel subdued, that pretty clearly comes under the abrogation concept, does it not?
Well, no, I differ with that, because the ayah in the Quran where Allah said, La ikraha fi al-deen, there's no compulsion in religion, still applies as far as personal belief and the adoption of Islam, for example, upon yourself, you know, to accept it and to embrace it. But as far as the authority and as far as the society is concerned, yes, we certainly believe that Sharia should be implemented and that should be the law and order. But nothing prevents you to have your church and your synagogue and to have your own matrimonial affairs and personal affairs according to your own law.
Well, in some parts of the world, notably in Saudi Arabia, that's certainly not permitted. But we're out of time. We've had a very interesting and, I think, informative conversation. In the remaining 2 minutes, let me just ask you to describe how you would envision achieving the triumph of Sharia in America as you seek it here in the United States.
Well, I would invite the people in America to embrace Islam and to look at the inimitability of the Quran and the example of the Prophet and hopefully embrace Islam themselves. And obviously that is the best way. And that, in fact, happened in certain parts of the world, like Indonesia and Malaysia and Ethiopia before, which were never, in fact, conquered. Another way, a second way, would be by an Islamic state with its foreign policy, annexing other lands to itself. And that is also a very real possibility if it were to be established, for example, somewhere else in the world. A third possibility is for certain sections of the American public to embrace Islam, for example, in the army or, you know, in the ruling elite, and they therefore implement the Sharia. And a fourth way could possibly be if there is a conflict, like what is taking place in Iraq or Afghanistan, and ultimately the Muslims end up in authority. Obviously, you know, we don't like to be in a position where we're fighting each other, but that is as well a possibility.
So, in short, most of these possibilities, other than voluntary, willing submission to this Sharia program, would involve some form of conquest, some sort of violent triumph of this program over our constitution, over our freedoms, over our way of life. Am I correctly understanding you?
Well, you know, Frank, I would say there are two types of violence. There's violence pro-life and against life. Like a doctor sometimes uses violence, a cesarean operation, to save life. And I think that the Sharia to be implemented is a mercy for mankind. And it means removing oppressive regimes, like the American one, as far as I'm concerned. I think this is a mercy for the American people.
Yeah. So this is a chilling assessment of our options under your program, Anjum Chowdhury. We have, I think, benefited from understanding the clarity that you bring to it, the relative lack of taqiyya in how you describe it, which is, I think, commendable, and the extent to which it really does clearly indicate a desire to replace our constitutional form of government, way of life, freedoms, and society with something very different is something we all need to be alive to. I appreciate you sharing your time with us for that purpose, and we'll look forward to a further visit with you in the future if you'll indulge us. And that's it for this installment of Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll find it interesting, and you'll tune in again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Over and out.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.